Hello, this is Boyer from the Macross Share blog, and this is Macross Share Radio, episode number 4, and it's March the 8th, the day before daylight savings time. It's also 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Central Standard Time. And this is, I guess I said episode 4 already. And we're talking with John Moscato, who has recently completed a 1/48 in-bit resin model and is in the process of working on the next MOSFET in-bit model. So I thought, oh, he's still working on resin models. Why not check in with him and see how he's doing? And we're going to work and we're going to see how the whole a process how he worked out from the beginning of his last model and how what he learned throughout that process. Well, hello, John Moscato. Are you there?
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Oh, okay, for a weekend after night shift work. I got some sleep and everything.
Well, you're going to get 1 hour less of sleep, so get used to
Oh,
it.
that's fine. I got some days off. That's the main thing. And so you've been keeping busy. So at least what I've seen on the
I try
board.
myself. Yeah.
So I also put together a production model diary of John's 1/48 in-bit grab. I'm guessing on the spelling of this Genesis Climber MOSFET Mecca, because there's so many websites have so many alternate spellings depending on I guess what how people translate the Japanese language. So that model kind of turned out fairly quickly. Is that your usual?
It's not, but you have to understand that it's a much simpler design than something like, let's say, a Destroid or, heaven forbid, a transforming mecha. So it's mostly jelly bean like shapes, which are sort of squished together to make something that looks like a crab. And so it posed some challenges as opposed to something which is more mechanical, something that I could, usually I could usually devote more to the milling machine and get much more precise shapes using tooling. Whereas this required a much more hands-on, old-fashioned approach because it was very organic, and I didn't feel comfortable taking it into the computer and trying to draft up plans just because I thought that it would take away from the organic feel that it's supposed to have. And that's actually one of the things that bothered me with the Invid designs is that I wasn't too sure if they should be considered more mechanical or if they should be more like giant exoskeleton organic armor. And I didn't want to mess with the design too much because I figured this is what people actually wanted. So I was as faithful as I could be to the line art, but that sort of does give me some ideas later on if I want to retackle that in a sort of stoned out haze and maybe tackle from a more organic perspective. But that's maybe far down the line.
So you're saying this version is more of a mechanical representation? In a way, rather than organic.
To me, it seems that way. It's a funny hybrid because I understand that in anything that's animated, particularly from that period, there were concessions that have to be made. I mean, take for example, like the box art for a lot of the EMI models or whatnot from the early 80s. I mean, they had much more detailed renderings and whatnot than what you would see in the animation, just because, when you're drawing, I don't know how many frames per second, you can't really afford to go into all that detail, or the project will take forever, cost too much money. So there are concessions made, and I'm really wondering, had they had more of a budget, or had there been more renderings of the InVid, would we have seen a more organic quality to them emerge? And that poses another question, because if you look at some of the Zentradi Mecha, that themselves were very, very organic, and how they were rendered in plastic form for kits. I mean, you see that it's like it's night and day. I mean, I don't like to be critical, but I don't think that the plastic models, particularly from the era, did justice to the original designs. And I can't help but wonder, had Musipedia been a little bit more popular from a sales perspective, had they gone into the enemy mecha, what would they have looked like? And I'm thinking probably like crap, but that's just me.
Well, from what I remember, a lot of those metals back in the 80s, they were, I don't think they had the manufacturing techniques or the tolerances that they do these days. So it's they a lot of them are just, very crude looking, or they had lots of flash, extra bits of plastic here and there, and they really need a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, which is not to say that there weren't some fairly nice and complex models done from that period, but I think because of the nature of the series that they were representing, there were budget constraints. So if you're thinking, okay, well, this thing has to retail for, 500 yen, they can't go and make something with 30 sprues and multiple colors and all that other kind of stuff.
Oh, so we could take a look at this model at from the start and say Corey Holmes had a question for you that's on page 9 of the Musipedia InBut in 1/48 Macross World thread. He said, "Captain, you were saying about how the InVid Mecha doesn't really lend itself well to things like joints and articulation based on the line art. Can you elaborate more on how you modified the designs from the paper to the kit to make such things possible?"
And that is a fascinating question, which unfortunately does not have a very simple answer. And it really depends on the design. It's really a case-by-case basis. And this goes back to what I was saying earlier about some parts of the InVid just look like blobs. And you look in one particular illustration, it's drawn one way, and then when you look at another view or whatever, it's completely different. And that happens a lot. So
Oh
that.
yeah, it's the translation of 2D versus 3D that I've seen in on the well, this is kind of tangential, but it's related that there's like a Walt Disney Donald Duck comic book version, and then there was a Walt Disney comic book, no, a Walt Disney Donald Duck statue version. But to try and translate the 2D into the 3D and like have everything look reasonably well as it would look on a comic book page is a lot of work, because it doesn't quite look right if in some ways, so you got to make some concessions.
Right, and this is what I think bears mentioning is that a lot of this stuff, well, actually, all of the animation style sheets from that period were drawn by hand. And sometimes perspective grids were used, sometimes they weren't. So you have views that really don't correspond, and the InVid, or InBit, I should say, are, I think, particularly prone to that because the shapes are very organic. And if you don't properly trace those on a perspective grid, just a slight modification, just putting a line 2 millimeters off, will completely change the look and feel. And you wonder why, okay, well, it looks good in this view, but then when I turn it around, it looks kind of messed up. And that is just part of the business and learning how to compromise. I mean, you'll always, at least from my perspective, I'll take a particular view that I like. Like, you know, that nice three-quarter front view that you get from most of the Mecca. And I'll consider that like my primary source. I want it to look as much as possible like this. And then you try to harmonize that with the other views and try to make as few concessions as possible. But, you know, sometimes you have to, you know, square things off a little bit here. And I mean, look, like with the Invid, the knee joints. I mean, that was a complete clusterfuck of
Oh.
sculpting, because they really just look like a bunch of rocks stuck together. And somehow this is supposed to be a joint. So I'm not really feeling that from this design, but I'll do the best that I can with what I have. And so all I can say is, well, to if someone's going to try to articulate that with ball joints later on, you have all my respect and all my admiration, because
Well, I've seen some amazing things done with some turning some, you know, models that you couldn't think possibly they'd be transformable, like some of those Hasegawa Valkyries. Some guy actually transformed like a 1/72 scale into like Jerwak, Batroid, and Fighter Mode, and it worked without
Yeah,
swapping out parts.
I was actually really impressed when I saw that. This was about a decade ago when the kits came out, I think.
Oh yeah.
And later on, obviously, Hasegawa did their own Batroids,
Oh yeah.
which, again, looked very nice, but looked different. But you could tell that it wasn't something that came from the aircraft per se.
Yeah, they were really trying to be as closely representational of the anime itself, or like idealized form of the anime. Because sometimes the
And
models look
again,
a lot better than the TV show.
and the thing is, it really all depends on what particular set of style sheets you want to work from, because everyone tries to make anime accurate, this, that, and the other thing. But in this particular view, it'll look one way, and in another drawing done by the same artist but from a different perspective, it looks completely different. You know, it has like fatter proportions. And so that, I think, is the beauty, and the drawback from that period is that there are so many different possible interpretations of the work that was done, as opposed to later stuff, which is all, you know, done by computers, so it's much more consistent. Back then, you know, you could take like several different artists to conceptualize and take this idea, put it in 3D, and you'd have different interpretations. And while one interpretation wouldn't necessarily work for someone, it would be beautiful to somebody else.
So on this Invid Gurab, were there certain parts of the design that you had to kind of play with to make it work?
I would say all of them.
Oh, not just the knees.
No, I mean the knees are probably the most glaring example of that problem. But it goes with the lower legs, because once again, in that stylized three-quarter view that's very popular, the leg is not perfectly symmetrical front to back. It has sort of a dynamic slope to it, and I tried to capture that in the model. And it creates some issues with the way that the foot works. And these are all things that are very hard to see coming until you're actually working in 3D.
So, you were saying somebody else had had a question about saying, like there's different designs for, say, the model than there would be for the toy. I don't know if you've ever, you know, bought or played with the Matchbox toy.
I did own those when I was younger, yes.
So, Do you remember that question he was asking you? Was he saying it was toy related design differences?
Where was this posted?
Oh, nuts. I thought you were telling me this. Never mind. Never mind. I'm sure there's really big changes you have to make in terms of toys and models. So
But
we'll just
yes.
focus in on the models. 'Cause I can see like the model the toy I had. I mean, this thing you had to play around with it just so it could balance properly. But it looked pretty good.
Well, to be perfectly honest, those were done by Matchbox,
Oh yeah.
and I don't think that they had a tremendous amount of experience making action figure type toys.
Oh, the action figures are terrible.
Yeah,
But
and
I thought the Mecha were, well, some of them are good because I really like the Destroids.
some of them were okay. Some of them were much less than okay, and I think the in-bit fall into that category, unfortunately.
So you can't imagine a good in-bit toy then.
I don't think they would be terribly hard to make with the technology that we have now.
Oh.
I think it has more to do with the fact that demand probably isn't there. It's always been sort of very tenuous for Mospita. And I mean, I don't know if you read just recently, I think one of the toy companies that was producing some of the more recent Mospita toys filed for bankruptcy.
Ooh, that's not Toynami, is it?
No, it's another CM. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, man, those Mospita toys were horribly expensive for their size. I heard they were good quality.
Well, therein lies the problem whenever you're talking about tooling, whether it's for models or for toys. Knowing that the model is very limited in its appeal, it's not like let's say Gundam. So your market is much smaller, so you have to offset your R&D costs over a much smaller production run. So that's going to up your price, like it or not. And that actually comes into a question that I get every once in a while. Models seem kind of pricey, and so I thought I'd feel that because every once in a while I'll get someone who's asking me, okay, well, sometimes you switch from Canadian currency to U.S. currency, and that actually has more to do with the exchange rate than anything else. If you look at the price in the last 10 years since I've been making garage kits, the price of plastic models, I would say, has pretty much doubled. I mean, take a look at the original Master Grade RX-78 Gundam, which was 2,500 yen, and
Okay.
they're going for now. You see that that kit prices have gone up. Mine have actually stayed about the same. It's really just with regards to the exchange between the U.S. and Canadian dollar. Because when I started making models originally in 2004, for every US dollar, I was getting about $1.35. So that saved me from having to put $135 price tag on a model, which is say 100 US. I was,
Because
doing very well from that.
you find most of the people who are buying you from the are from the US?
I would say categorically about 90% to 90 to 95% of the market is in the States. And so it was just easier for everybody when I would put things in US dollars. And as the Canadian dollar started to close in on parity with the US dollar, I was actually starting to lose
Oh
money. It
yeah.
was crazy. For 1 US dollar, I was getting like 93 cents as opposed to $1.35. So that really changes the landscape a lot.
I would hope that you're charging enough to cover, materials and, the time that it takes to make these things.
It's for the most part, I can stay in the black. This is not the kind of business that you go into if you want to make big money. I can tell you that right away. It's the production runs are fairly small right now. I'm looking at between anywhere from 30 to 45 kits being done. So that's about as small a production run as you can expect to make, and still be able to cut into the black.
Yeah, it seems like this is a niche market because of its one that's Mospita and it's a Mecca. And so a lot of this would be like direct sales and trying to build up good customer relations and trying to get your word out there that you can do these things. 'Cause geez, I'm not too sure how you anybody would find you if you.
Well, it primarily, I'm in the forums, and that's where I would probably stay for the foreseeable future. Just because I don't like to attract too much attention to myself, considering the nature of what I do. I may end up creating a website with some models at some point, but that's a little bit down the road.
Well, I was listening to the latest Macross speaker podcast this morning. They got episode 12, part one up, and they were saying Tengen had put together a limited run of the Do You Remember Love like chest armor. You know how they had the Yamato came out with the big helmet. So Tengen actually got around to it wasn't just him, but I think he had a bunch of guys, but he was like in charge of the project to design this thing and make it to sell it at the latest Wonderfest out in Japan. But then there was a weather problem and he was having trouble getting to the Wonderfest on time, so he came in late and they ended up having not being able to sell all this stuff. But it's like Wonderfest is this modeling convention that happens like was it at least a couple times a year in Japan, and they grant like this limited license to produce models. So Tengen, I believe, got a license to produce like 20 of these chest armors in a year. And you can either try to sell them all at once at one convention or space them out for all conventions that happen in the year. So I don't know if that's an option as well for you.
Believe it or not, we, when I say we, I say the owner of the now defunct Samurai Monkey website was looking into that, and he was very interested in getting me to participate. And I had submitted some resin castings for approval, and they're basically you hit the highlights of the criteria. You can only produce, X amount during the year, which is about 20. And, there are certain constraints. I think at the time you could only sell at the convention and not outside. That may have changed. And I felt it was, and this is purely from my perspective, I felt that there were just a ridiculous amount of hoops to jump through for such a small run. And I think most people who do that do it for the pure pleasure because there isn't really much money to be made in terms of such a small run. I mean, that's ridiculously small.
Well, I think the licensors of the anime grant this because they know these hobbyists cannot possibly make a regular business out of it. They do it that they consider this just like a fan-based fun thing, so that if you just break even, that's all they really expect. That's why they give the license in the first place, from what I've seen.
Right. And I don't know, the idea of having to pay a percentage on top of having to, eat up all the costs of production and maybe getting to sell your under in Wonderfest, at least to me, didn't seem like a very good trade-off. So I chose to go down the route that I went, where I basically now I stay away from any kind of trademarked artwork or any kind of copyrighted names, and I can essentially just produce the sculpt and market it with a different name and my own artwork, and that doesn't seem to cause any problems. So it's a trade-off. I mean, if it was a bigger market, if it was, let's say, Gundam franchise or Star Trek or something that's fairly well known, at that point, I think it's much more worthwhile to get the license because you have such a broad market to appeal to. But for something that's as esoteric as Mospita, I'm actually very surprised that a company like Wave came up with the 1/72nd scale Legios Armor of Soldier.
Oh, is that recent?
Was
Oh.
that last year?
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing this like very nice posters of the Legos, and I thought, "Oh, where do these come from?" So I guess that must be the modeled box art. I think it is.
That would probably be it, and kudos to them for doing such nice box art. But it again, it just comes back to the fact that it's such a not very well-known series. I think particularly in Japan, I mean the US and Canada I think are still very fond of the designs because of Robotech. And so that has allowed it perhaps to gain a second life and appeal to fans for longer than it did in Japan. And because I think if you look at all the companies that have been associated with making Mospita toys, there's an alarming regularity with them, going into bankruptcy.
I suppose that's one of the reasons why Bandai has been making all these limited editions of their Macross Valkyries, because they know they produce so many, they know the set price that will make them a profit, and they won't be stuck with a whole lot of extra stock afterwards.
Well, generally, what will happen is a manufacturing company, let's say like Bandai, will only produce based on the orders that they get. Companies don't usually produce extra. It's not worth it for them because then they have to store the extra stock. That means, warehouse fees associated with that, and it's a waste of resources. So they basically just take the orders, and if they get, let's say, an order for 50,000 total, they'll just pump out 50,000 and that's it. And once they get enough orders to justify another run, whatever that number should be, then they go ahead and do it.
So it's really maybe the retailers or distributors who are stuck with the extra stock if they're not sold, I guess.
That's pretty much, I think, what happened with Mospita, because those are kits from the early, not even mid-80s. And I mean, you can still see some floating around now on eBay. And I'm talking about the original boxes from the 1980s.
Oh, yeah. And let's see. So if you want to take a look at the 1/38 InBit production model diary, if you want to open that up and see how you
It
look.
is open.
Okay. So I kind of designed it a little bit more like an e-book rather than picture text. So I thought it looked a little nicer. And then if were you able to skim it over, or just kind of you're just looking at it now, or
I'm looking at it now, and I had the dubious distinction of being able to live it.
oh
So
yeah
it's all still fairly fresh in my memory.
oh that's good. So if there's any, if you want to just flip through a couple pages, and if you see something that looks like, were there some parts of this process that sticks in your mind that you learned something from that was different from your last project, or something you can carry forward to the next? Because I know you're going from one MBID project, but you're going to the next MBID, which does look different.
It's the next project is actually a whole different ball of wax. It's it has that double Canon design, and the cannons act like eyes, and that particular shape is going to be quite a challenge, because I was looking at the animation style sheets, and as per their regular way of doing things, they don't add up. So I'm going to have to make some interesting creative concessions to harmonize all that. I don't think there's really anything to add with regards to the Gurab, but since it's still in the vein of Mospita, I'd like to maybe, if you would indulge me, touch a little bit on the 1/32nd scale Lagios.
Okay.
Because there's actually a lot more to that than people understand. When I started that project in 2001, I was under no time constraints. There was no one breathing down my neck. I had no fans waiting for me to build anything. And this was purely for me. And might be interesting to give people some insight as to why it turned out looking the way that it did, because I think you'll notice that it's quite different. Although it carries the same feel of the Lagios that you see in the line art, there are some fairly important changes that were made to it. And there's an interesting story behind that, because when I first started making this mecha, I looked and I said, well, okay, I can make this thing any way that I want. And obviously, I'd like to keep it looking more or less like that it does in the animation, but I'd like to modernize it. I'd like to make certain things real world. And one of the biggest things that bothered me was that most of the stated dimensions in the animation reference would make this jet horribly small. And for the average sized man, which is I think between 5'9" and 6', you're basically not going to be able to fit into a cockpit of this thing unless you're shoehorned in with a lot of grease. So I told myself the first thing that I would have to do is I would have to basically work around the dimensions of a normal human body. And so what I did is, before I started anything off, I mocked up using cardboard a very rudimentary cockpit. And I wanted to make sure, okay, well, I have to be wearing armor in this thing. And so the seat has to be a certain distance from the front instrument panel. The side panels have to be a certain width. I have to be able to move around, at least in some minimal respect, to be able to access things. And so everything started off from the cockpit. And if you look at the dimensions of my kit, let's see, you bring that up, because it's in 1/32nd scale. It's actually probably closer in dimensions to an FA-18 than the original Legios.
So, in the anime, it's a much smaller plane.
It's a much, much smaller plane. So it when I got my grubby hands on it, it grew somewhat. And then I thought to myself, okay, well, let's examine the scenario that this particular piece of weaponry would be operating in. The Earth has been for all intents and purposes, abandoned for at least a generation. So any kind of infrastructure that may have been there in the past probably isn't anymore. So you're sending soldiers and equipment into a very hostile environment with virtually no backup, probably limited supplies of weaponry, food. They wouldn't necessarily have access to hangars and places where that they could make repairs. And so the equipment would have to be extremely durable. It would have to go perhaps weeks and weeks and weeks in the field without any kind of maintenance. So I took all these things into consideration, and I tried to place as many of the access panels low down to the ground, as low as possible, so that if, let's say, you didn't have access to scaffolding, any kind of ladders, hydraulic lifts, you could still basically do maintenance on the aircraft. And if you notice under a lot of the panels, let's say the engine pods or the nose cones, you'll see that there's a lot of very large plumbing that goes through there. And that wasn't because I got lazy and decided, well, I'm just going to use, you know, larger pieces of styrene rod. What I actually did was I thought to myself, okay, well, the all of the wiring and all of the systems have to be protected from electromagnetic radiation, from weapons, moisture, anything that could come in there that would screw up with the systems, cause them to malfunction. So what as I did is I sort of imagined all of the systems as being encapsulated in sort of like carbon fiber nanotubes.
Okay.
So that everything would basically be protected from the elements and would also offer a certain amount of protection from weaponry. And I actually had the idea at some point, and this is just me going off into a crazy tangent. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do a kind of, most military modelers will remember the Verlinden lock-on series. Oh. They were these.
Not me.
Okay. Well, to give you a quick recap, they were a series of color illustration books, basically picture books with a little bit of text. And they were very nice, large format color photos of different tanks and aircraft. And what would happen is the photographer would just go around and photograph virtually section by section of the aircraft, panels open, panels closed. Give you an idea of the placement of the rivets, close-up shots of the landing gear, and I was thinking of doing something like that with the Legios.
Hmm.
And I even had the idea of doing a production diary where basically when this aircraft was being built and tested, it would have to endure the armor on this thing would have to be stronger than any kind of armor that was designed previously. And I actually had a scenario in my head where they would be mounting, let's say, a nose cone cockpit on a stand, and they would fire on it with large bore tank guns to see how many shots it would take to finally penetrate the armor.
Those are kind of the tests that we'd actually do on real fighter jets?
I don't think they would use weaponry anywhere near that extreme because at our current juncture in our technological understanding, there are still weight considerations. And I think the only aircraft that would come close to that would be the A-10. I think they actually do take one of the titanium cockpit tubs, and they will fire a 20-millimeter cannon at it to make sure that the cockpit is sturdy. And I basically just wanted to take that concept and ratchet it up many times over.
So a lot of the details on the models that you have in mind, there's a whole background of information that you put into it then.
Oh yeah, I mean, I did not design things willy-nilly. Even the way that the ladder stows into the leading edge extension of the aircraft, I figured, okay, well, you can't necessarily have ladders lying around and whatever. You may not even have access to them. So everything, as much as possible, has to be incorporated into the aircraft. And I also had a lot of fun with the engine intakes, because they have those panels that close up
There's the little
on the
f
chest.
Oh yeah, the little flaps. I think
Yeah.
I see that picture there.
And I told myself, well, these are actually very interesting because they could act as FOD screens.
FOD would mean.
Because if you look at the FOD being foreign object damage,
Oh, like birds and
because
such.
yes, well, birds, rocks, any kind of debris that might be on a runway, because most of the aircraft in the Western world is made to taxi from fairly clean runways, and in a future apocalyptic scenario where the Earth would be abandoned for like 20 some odd years, you probably wouldn't have any real runways left. So these aircraft would have to be able to land in grass fields, on dirt, basically anywhere that was remotely flat enough to bring down an aircraft. And so that's why I tweaked the landing gear and really made this very sturdy landing gear, something that you would find. It's, I think, probably even bigger than the landing gear on an F-14. It's really rugged. It's almost like a dune buggy that takes to the sky. So the chest flaps would act as FOD screens and would allow the top portion to stay open to suck in air for the engines, but at the same time the bottom sections would remain closed to keep out any debris. So I had a lot of fun with all these little things and adding chaff and flare dispensers, expendable countermeasures.
And that was a 10-year process, though.
I had actually worked out most of these things from the get-go.
Oh.
And that probably surprises people, but if those who were still on the forums remember back when I was doing this in the early 2000s, most of the details were actually there. And what happened is I, because of various reasons, it just never got finished. I did rework the nose cone because if you look at the original diaries, the nose cone was much shorter.
Oh yeah.
I had opted to do something that was more like a hairier nose cone, fairly short and stubby. And while that was, practical from an aircraft's perspective, I think the fans did not care too much for the aesthetics, and
It
so
didn't quite look like
I
the
ended up
anime
making a
version,
permanent.
or
It just looked off. Like it was practical in my mind, but it didn't look nice. And since this is, a model that's, supposed to be admired, I decided to make some concessions and, lengthen the nose cone to make it more streamlined in fighter mode.
But still keeping in mind all the background world details that you're trying to incorporate in the model, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, there are access panels inside the landing gear wheel wells. I had gone and put some electrical systems in there that, could be accessed by ground crew and various things of that nature. And I really had a lot of fun. I even gave some purpose to that shoulder pod, that mysterious white shoulder pod that you see in diver and soldier mode. And I told myself, okay, well, what real world, what could this thing be used for? And I came up with the idea that it would act as a kind of encrypted radio link with the fleet higher up in orbit. So it could be used to send encrypted information back and forth. If they didn't want to use their radar, they could use the sensory systems from orbiting vessels, and that data could be transmitted by encrypted signal to the fighters to let them know, let's say we're in bit, we're at large distances.
Kind of like a GPS system of some sort.
Yes. And I also told myself that it could also function as a terrain following radar, so that the portion that was closest to the ground could be used to map terrain. Basically, that could be stored into the computer so as to help the pilot not only navigate but fight when you're, you know, dealing with very high speeds and turning at very very sharp angles, to make sure that you don't run into the ground or anything when you're maneuvering.
There is one extra bit that I remember on one of the models that was kind of odd. It was almost like an extra missile pod that sat in the back of the Legios.
Yes.
But yes. I don't see that on every model version of Legios, though.
Well, as it turns out, what happened was that, as the story goes, when Imai was working on the model kit, they discovered that between the shoulders there would sort of like be this huge gaping hole, because the nose cone basically folds back into that space in soldier mode. So you have, in fighter mode, like it or not, you would have sort of a big open space. And yeah. I think they figured that looked kind of hideous. So I think they proposed the idea for a missile pod that would cover over that hole and also offer extra weaponry. And I think you see that in one episode of the series, mm-hmm. but never again. And I kind of got around that problem by just making armor panels that would fold over each other.
I think that's how the Toynami Turbo version kind of got around it. Just kind of, they just covered it up with a flap and just said, whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, you take the means that are at your disposal, because the toy itself was already extremely complex, and I think that lent itself to the fact that many people were complaining about parts coming loose, arms breaking off, mm-hmm. And the toy was actually based off of, very closely off, the EMI model kit, which was notoriously fragile because of the way that it was designed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you copy a certain design, you also inherit certain problems, like it or not.
So say, for the 148th in-bit, did you also have a background story to how this you developed the design on this in-bit?
I didn't, because the design was already so very simple. It didn't require any kind of a complex cockpit. It didn't have to transform. So the criteria for the in-bit were much more simplistic, I guess you could say. And I also didn't, like I said earlier, I didn't want to mess with the design and do something that was, you know, overly organic, that would stray from the line art. I might give myself permission to do that at some future point, but I think people really wanted what they saw in the animation style sheets, and that's what I was intent on producing. I said that this would be an interesting opportunity to really be able to give this design the attention that it has not received and over, you know, these many, many years. And someone in the modeling forums, or at least on the Gurab thread, was mentioning how they were having difficulty getting the cannons to line up horizontally because of the way that the kit is made. Mm-hmm. And a little tidbit of useful information that I can give is that the resin, the two pegs that hold the beam cannons, you can actually put those in boiling water for about a minute, and it will make the resin become sort of rubbery. And so what I can suggest is that if people are having difficulty getting the cannons to line up properly, all they have to do is just use a little bit of heat, whether it be hot water or a hairdryer, and just bend those two supporting beams until the cannons are straight. So it's a very easy fix.
Okie dokie. Did you want to browse the PDF and see if something comes up that you wanted to mention?
I'm actually looking at it now.
Okay,
and I think everything is fairly straightforward. Although someone recently just asked me about the modeling board that I use, what form comes in and how I cut it. And this stuff used to be made by Siba Geigy, and that was later taken over. It's now being produced by a company called Freeman. It's the exact same modeling board, and the format that I get it in is in slabs. It's a sheet that is about 50 inches by 16 inches and 2 inches thick. And what I do to cut it, quite simply, is I take a circular saw and I just cut it in sections that I need. Most of the time I'll use the circular saw just because it'll maintain a nice straight cut. But every once in a while you just need a small portion and you don't want to bother with, you know, making a big mess in the garage. So I'll literally just take a handsaw and hack off a piece. And the process from that point on is pretty much cataloged in the build diaries, where I'll put it on the milling machine to make sure that it's nice and straight. Mm-hmm. You can use a bandsaw on it. It's the material that I use is density 460. I think it's density 460. So it's a nice medium ground between something that can be machined and also something that can be worked by hand. Like you can take a Dremel, you can take sandpaper, and you can work it without too much difficulty. You can find finer densities of this material, yes, but I don't recommend them unless you have a CNC machine at your disposal, because you'll pretty much not be able to work it by hand. It's just too dense. Mm. And someone said, well, you know, is it possible to cobble together or add certain sections together, glue them together to make a bigger piece? And absolutely, yes. That's one of the beauties of this material, is that I use either some CA glue. People can use epoxy, but I think the CA glue is better because it cures much more quickly. And there have been times where literally I've taken a bunch of just leftover pieces, cobbled them together with a combination of CA glue and Bondo putty, mm-hmm. and just used that to create one large piece from my leftovers and sculpt my part from that.
Mm. Okie dokie. And so that looks like we covered a lot of material there. And I'm just flipping through the PDF, see if I can think of anything else that'd be good to ask or mention.
See, with regards to the InBit, like I said, it was such a simple project compared to some of the other things that I had done. I don't know if there's a whole lot to be covered.
Well, other than, I know you initially tried to start off the InBits with the protector
That's right.
version, which
Yep.
is actually pretty big.
In the scale that I wanted to do it, yep.
And yet didn't create enough interest, so I guess I didn't start. And then
That's always a bit of a touchy subject because a few years ago I tried to get a GearLab project going and it fizzled out also. I think it has more to do with timing and making sure that you reach the people that need to be reached. And sometimes people aren't expecting that kind of a thread to pop up. And they haven't, let's say, visited the site in a few weeks, a few months. So it's very easy for something like that to slip between the cracks. Sometimes it's just a question of timing.
Maybe people are getting some money back from income tax this year.
Well, that is another possibility right there.
Well, I'm hoping you'll get a like a Pokemon effect, and you'll go from the Gamo to the, I guess, the Egea, and then you can get back the protector because everybody needs a complete set.
Well, I thought that was a very fascinating mecha, the protector, and I'm absolutely willing to tackle it in the future if people are interested. There's also the Ghost suit, the version of the InBit armor with the humanoid pilots. I think that would be an interesting project. A little bit more pricey, obviously, because it's more complex. But
Would it be, what kind of scale can you imagine that would be, though?
it would actually end up being a little bit smaller than the Gamo. The Gamo is actually a huge honking mecha. It, depending on what source reference you look at, it's either just slightly shorter than a Legios or slightly taller. Whereas the Ghost suit is, I think, right about the same size as a Legios, but it doesn't have to transform. So, it's a little bit simpler than a transforming mecha in that respect, but certainly more complex than the InBit that I've tackled so far. But I still think it would make a fascinating project.
So you tend to tackle on one project at a time, or are you having other projects in the background there?
I actually do have other projects in the background that are not related to animation. And what happens is, when I'm doing R&D, there are usually periods where I end up having to wait for approval for things to get done. So I can squeeze in an animation project here and there. And I'd let it go for some time once I finished the Legios. And at first I was like, oh, such a large weight has been lifted from my shoulders. I'd been doing animation kits for so long that I needed a break. But once I recharged my batteries, I started to miss it again. That's why I came back. Because I mean, this to me is not work. This is just having fun. And I have the privilege of having other people who enjoy what I do as much as I do, and perhaps even more, and are willing to pay me for it.
All right. Okay, so I guess we basically covered everything we can think of for now,
Yeah,
and
and we've got at least an hour of audio too.
oh geez, yeah. So I'll be posting the production model diary of the 148th Gureb that John Moscato had finished up in December on the MacroShare script account, and I'll be posting like notices on the MacroShare blog and on the Macross World forum. So it's basically the same forum thread, but compressed to the details that you can really see how John progressed through the line art, the production, to even and then nice copy to even have for the instructions. So if you missed out on getting a Gureb, it's nice that it's out there. And I'd like to thank John Moscato for taking part in this interview.
Yeah,
And
I would to. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to sit down and chit chat with me. It was a lot of fun. Brought back a lot of memories, and hopefully we can do another portion at some point in the future.
maybe. Of course, I might be busy for the next month or so because I'm thinking MechTech has this Daedalus project. One, I think it's 1/200th scale. Could be 1/250th. He's just about got it ready so he can put it on the water and drive it around or something. But I thought that's like a 8 to 10 year project there. I was thinking putting together like a production model diary or an ebook of that, with videos and audio interviews and kind of a geez, thanks for putting together your really cool stuff there.
Absolutely, because I've visited that thread many times, and kudos to him. That is just an absolutely fantastic project, and I can't wait to see it completed.
Well, I think he's just been it's been dependent on the weather, because I think the painting process, it has to be the right humidity or something, or the right temperature, or it just throws everything off. I'll talk to him more about that later. But anyways, that's another project I was thinking. And of course, I like to keep up with watching what you're doing. And of course, and there's other projects always happening on Macross World, so I like visiting Macross World. So I'll probably do another interview. I'm not too sure which we'll be talking to just yet, but I'll try to keep everybody posted. And thank you. And I guess that was the interview. I'll talk to you later. Bye, John.
All right, take care.
Oh.